Okay, so I thought I'd start out with the obligatory spectrum of the high-redshift quasar. Notice that in this spectrum, the Lyman alpha forest doesn't look so nice. That's because I don't like it too well. So, for me, it's been a source of confusion, noise, and aggravation, because even though a lot of people have made their careers out of it, it prevents what I'm really interested in are these heavy hitters over here, the damp Lyman alpha systems. Remember, the Lyman alpha forest clouds have columns about 10 to the 13th, 10 to 14 particles per square centimeter. But this particular guy over here at a redshift of 3.9 has a column 5 times 10 to the 20. And as all damp Lyman alpha systems, it has low ions. All of them have metals, but in particular, they have significant low ion absorption, O1 and carbon 2. To me, the distinguishing characteristic of the damp Lyman alpha systems is that the gas is neutral, and this is in contrast to the Lyman alpha forest. Remember, the Lyman alpha forest clouds are optically thin at the Lyman limit. They have low density, and therefore ionizing background radiation penetrates them, ionizing them such that the neutral fraction is less than 10 to the minus 5. The kinetic temperature is probably 20,000 Kelvin or something like that. By contrast, damp Lyman alpha systems have enormous Lyman limit optical depths, so that radiation cannot get in, okay, which raises the question, what is it that heats the damp Lyman alpha systems? But to me, neutrality is crucial because stars don't form in low-density hot clouds like the Lyman alpha forest. Stars, you know, in our own galaxy form in molecular clouds, and molecular clouds are believed to be the descendants of atomic clouds in our own galaxy. And this is very interesting because when it's realized that the damp Lyman alpha systems dominate the neutral gas content of the universe between the redshifts 0 and 5, and even more important, at high redshifts, the amount of mass they contribute per unit co-moving volume is comparable to what the visible matter density of the universe is. And this is from recent work by Jason and a student of his. And this is the mass per unit co-moving volume in neutral gas as a function of redshift. These are the DLAs. And this is the most recent determination of the current visible matter density in galaxies from Fukakita. And you can see about a redshift between 3 and 4, the amount of mass per unit co-moving volume is about 40% of the visible mass. Okay. And so this has led to the idea, I mean, this argument's been around for about the last 20 years almost, that the DLAs serve as important neutral gas reservoirs for star formation at high redshift. In other words, of all the quasar absorption systems, they're probably the only ones that really qualify as true interstellar media. Okay. That being said, the next question is there really independent evidence that star formation is going on in these objects? And here it's more problematic. As you can see, as you go forward in time, there's really no significant evidence for evolution. The naive expectation many years ago was in the closed box model, as you go forward in time, the gas density would be consumed and converted into stars, but really see, we really can't make that argument here. In fact, if there is star formation, and I'll argue later on, if there is, globally, if there is star formation, that would mean that the infall rate of neutral gas into these things has to equal the star formation rate. So what are the other evidences for star formation? Well, one would expect an increase in metallicity. Metal production is a byproduct of star formation. If there really is star formation in damp systems, one would expect to see an increase in metallicity. And here's the latest from our work. One of the nice things about damp Lyman alpha systems is you don't have to make a significant ionization correction, which plagues the Lyman alpha forest. We know the ionization state for most of these objects. There are some exceptions, but for most of them, we know the ionization state very well. And so these are the most accurate metallicities determined at high redshift. So this is metal abundance in logarithmic units with respect to solar. So 0 is solar, minus 1 is 10%, minus 2 is 1%. These are undepleted elements, typically sulfur, silicon, in some cases zinc, plotted against redshift. These are the data points. This is from Keck. notice that the data points, the box size is proportional to the log of the H1 column density. And the reason we do that is what we're really interested in is the cosmic metallicity. The cosmic metallicity is the column density weighted mean. Okay. And that's what these black data points over here in these different redshift bins. So there's two things to notice. Again, this basically verifies what Patini said probably 15 years ago, that Bent lime and alpha systems are metal poor. The average metal lithium is about minus 1.3 dex, or maybe a little bit lower. Solar, notice that there's a floor in metallicity. We don't see any metallicities less than minus 2.6 dex. We could easily have gone down to minus 4. So remember, the lime and alpha forests, it depends on who you talk to, it's somewhere between minus 2 and minus 3, but that's the central mean metallicity. So whatever it is that's enriching the damp lime and alpha systems, they have a different enrichment history than the lime and alpha forest. Okay. And third, I think these are two sigma error bars. So we think for the first time we are seeing significant increase in metallicity as you go forward in time. It's almost better to see that by looking at it plotted as a function of time. We're really not sampling a lot of cosmic time at high redshifts. But roughly speaking, the metallicity is doubling every giga year. And of course, if that just kept going, we would wind up at solar abundance if that happened all the way to a redshift of zero. But notice that low redshifts, the abundances don't seem to be going to zero redshift. We don't know yet precisely what the reason for that is. One possibility is undersampling. To get a column density weighted mean, you need probably 100 sight lines to really sample the inner metal-rich regions. So we don't have that yet at low redshift. And another reason could be of obscuration by dust, which I'll talk more about. So there is some evidence for star formation, but it's indirect. The other evidence for star formation is dust. And we know that dust is a byproduct of star formation. The best evidence we have for dust at high redshift comes indirectly from depletion. And here we're just arguing along by analogy with the interstellar medium of the Milky Way. I'm plotting the zinc to iron abundance versus the zinc abundance here. And zinc is an undepleted element in the ISM, whereas iron is very heavily depleted. And one would expect as you go to more metal-rich regions, there's more iron atoms ready to deplete onto dust grains. And that's exactly what we see. As the zinc abundance increases, the zinc-to-iron ratio goes up. What we would like to know is what's going on at very low metallicities, because that would give us the nucleosynthetic intrinsic ratio. The problem is that zinc is a very weak transition, and we can't use zinc for that purpose. For that, we've used silicon. Even though silicon is weakly depleted, I mean, it's depleted somewhat, but it's very weakly depleted in damp lime and alpha systems because of the very low metallicity. So it's less striking here, but at least we see evidence. Again, if I plot the silicon to iron ratio versus silicon abundance for dust, but notice what happens as we go to very low silicon abundance, we seem to be hitting an asymptote, which goes to about 0.3. And this is not a unique explanation, but we think what this means is that population 2, that this gas is being enriched by type 2 supernovae. Okay, there's not general agreement about that in the community, but that's our group, that's our interpretation of the data. So, and there is other evidence that I'll discuss later on for star formation, but I would say right now that there is some evidence for star formation. It's indirect in DLAs. Part of the problem, the best way to see star formation is to see starlight directly, okay? And people have been trying for years to see the starlight in DLAs, but that's a challenge because what you're looking for is a 26th magnitude galaxy within one arc second of an 18th magnitude quasar. It's a non-trivial task, even with HST. So for this reason, it seemed to me a number of years ago that what we should do is develop a technique for measuring star formation, which is just depends on absorption line data alone. And that would complement, say, the technique that Chuck described yesterday, looking at galaxies in emission, because we would be able to probe further down the protogalactic mass distribution. We would be looking at a sample that's cross-section weighted rather than flux-limited. So what I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about is this new technique we've been using called the C2 star method. And my main partners in this are Jason Prochaska, who's here, Erica Weiser, and Chris Houck. And the idea is that I think we have to give up the old traditional idea of DLAs as layers of gas that transmit light from distant quasars that are very passive. I think at least a significant fraction of these damp lime and alpha systems, we believe, are sites of active star formation, and also they're a multi-phase media. And in keeping with the spirit of this meeting, I think the goal of what we're trying to do is measure radiative feedback in damp lime and alpha systems, because I think that's what we're seeing. So the idea is straightforward. As I said, there is evidence for supernovae, enrichment type 2 supernovae in DLAs. And the idea is we have massive upper main sequence stars that carve out, have a plane parallel layer, take the simplest model, uniform layer of neutral hydrogen, generate upper main sequence stars. They carve out giant H2 regions with their ionizing photons, and they get used up at the Strongman sphere. But far UV photons, say photons with energies between 6 and 13.6 eV, escape out, propagate through the ISM, and illuminate grains, which you know to be present, as I've just said. And certain fraction of that radiant energy goes into ejecting photoelectrons. These photoelectrons undergo Coulomb interactions with the ambient electrons, and that's how the gas is heated. Now, this is not a new idea. I mean, this is how we think grain photoelectric heating is widely believed to be the way in which the ISM of the Milky Way is heated, okay? In that case, the heating rate per atom is proportional to three numbers. Thus, the gas ratio, the photoelectric efficiency, and the mean intensity of far UV radiation. Now, let's look at each one of these quantities. The mean intensity is just any layer. It's just an, especially these are optically thin, the dust content is so low. The mean intensity is just a line integral over a source function, which in this case is just the luminosity of far UV radiation per unit volume. So that integral then is just equal to the luminosity per unit area, okay, from very young stars. Okay, and of course, the luminosity per unit area for very young stars is just the star formation rate at the same time times the upper main sequence time. So I think one of the things that we realized is that the mean intensity is proportional not to the absolute star formation rate, but to the star formation rate per unit area. Secondly, the dust-to-gas ratio, we're going to assume that the dust in these objects is similar to the dust in the Milky Way and make the simplest assumption, either silicates or carbonaceous grains. As I said, silicon is very weakly depleted. We really can't measure it. And for technical reasons, we can't measure the depletion of carbon. What we can measure is the depletion of iron. So what we're going to assume is that the number of depleted carbon atoms per depleted iron atom is the same in DLAs as it is in the galaxy, although I'll relax that assumption later. And so if we can measure, say, for example, the intrinsic silicon abundance and the iron to silicon ratio, we can calculate the dust to gas ratio. We think we can do that to about a factor of 2. The quantum efficiency of photoelectric heating depends upon the phase of the gas. If it's cold neutral medium, it's a maximum because the grains are neutral. The photoelectrons get out very easily. And they say the gas is 100 Kelvin, density of 10, 20 particles per cubic centimeter. In a dilute warm neutral medium, okay, where the electron recombination onto the grains is lower, the grains become positively charged, okay, and the quantum efficiency goes down. But at least this is well understood by a number of papers by Bruce Strain and his colleagues, and also Xander Thielens. In any case, we think we know something about kappa and epsilon, and that means if we can measure the heating rate, we can ultimately determine the star formation rate per unit area. So the way we determine the heating rate is to assume thermal balance, and that means the heating rate per atom is equal to the cooling rate per atom. Now, we know something about how the ISM cools, okay, in our own galaxy, but the dominant coolant by far is this 158 micron emission line, okay? This is a transition between these two fine structure states in the ground term of singly ionized carbon. It's the dominant coolant by far, by orders of magnitude. It exceeds all the CO lines put together in the galaxy, okay? And of course, you know, the best way to measure this would be go out and detect an emission, but if I get time, I'll say something about that later. You really need ALMA to do that, okay? But it turns out, luckily, we don't really have to wait to ALMA to learn something about this. We can use telescopes, ground-based optical telescopes, because the reason is that we can calculate the cooling rate per atom integrated or averaged along the line of sight, because that's equal to the column density of ions in this excited fine structure state times the energy in the Einstein-A coefficient, this transition, divided by the H1 column density, okay? And luckily, there is a transition that's been known, the ISM people have known this for years, okay, that arises from this excited fine structure state going to high level with a wavelength of 1335.7 angstroms. And so for the last probably 4 years now, my colleagues and I have been going to Keck measuring this transition, looking for it, is a better way to say it. And we've probably have data about 50 objects, and we've detected it in about half of those. So the bottom line is, by measuring this transition, the straightforward physics, we can infer the cooling rate per atom. We know something about the thermodynamics of these objects. Just to show you a little bit of data, this is typically what we see. This is a velocity profile of a resonance transition, and here's a velocity profile of this what's called C2 star transition. And in almost every case, they have the same velocity structure. So to summarize what we've done, what I'm plotting here is the carbon emission rates per atom versus the H1 column density. The red data points are positive detections. The dotted red ones are unpublished, and we haven't published them yet. The green are the upper limits. And as I said, in half the objects we've looked at, we've not detected it yet. But the interesting comparison is with the galaxy, okay, this big star over here. As I said, the COBE satellite detected this in 1992, the galaxy. So what you can do is just average over the plane of the galaxy, divide by the H1 mass, and this is the average, global average, cooling rate per atom in the Milky Way, okay? And, of course, we have upper limits and some lower limits, but if you just look at the median, okay, of the positive detections, it's about a 30th. The heating rate in DLAs, and I'm equating this now to a heating rate, in DLAs is about a 30th of what it is in the Milky Way. And I think that number is significant, because if we make the assumption that's the same physics at high redshift, the same type of grains, okay, and let's assume that the star formation rate per unit area in DLAs is the same as it in the galaxy, or more accurately, the mean intensity is the same, then the ratio of the heating rates in DLAs with respect to the Milky Way is just equal to the ratio of the dust to gas ratios. And as Pittini showed 15 years ago, that ratio is also about a 30th, I mean, with a big error bar. Nonetheless, the numbers are very similar. So the ansatz I'm going to make here is that in damp Lyman alpha system, the reason that the cooling and heating rates are low is not because the star formation rates are low, but rather it's because there's less dust. Star formation rates are the same. Now that's just, so far it's just an order of magnitude argument. It's not a rigorous argument. So we went into this more deeply. We constructed multiphase models using the formalism that Chris McKee, Mark Wolfire, and their colleagues have used, and just subjected a layer of gas to heating, grain photoelectric heating. And because there's star formation rate, there's going to be other types of heating due to X-rays, cosmic rays. We make the assumption that the X-ray heating rate and the cosmic ray heating rate are proportional to the star formation rate and normalized to the galaxy. Cooling is well known for years how the ISM cools. It's lots of fine structure emission from other ions, not just carbon-2, metastable ions. We're going to allow the gas to be warm, so Lyman alpha can be an important coolant, and grain recombination, electron recombination on the grains. And then we just solve for thermal equilibrium. Yeah, I'm leaving out the ionized gas, and I'll talk about that later. Give me a minute. Ionized gas is not important for this. Okay, so for starters, as I said, the Lyman alpha forest is heated by background radiation. What about the DLAs? So we looked at this possibility. Now remember, for DLAs, the Lyman limit optical depth is about 1,000 or more. So photons around a Rydberg don't get in. What gets in are soft X-rays and far UV radiation. So what we did, we used the famous unpublished background radiation fields by Piero Medel and Francesco Hart, and which are widely quoted everywhere. And we subjected each of our objects to this heating. So this is, let's say, a DLA at a redshift of 3.9, okay? And this is the carbon emission rates you get in thermal equilibrium. So let me say something about that. So we just take a whole series of models and increase the density, use the ISM cooling curve. So at low densities, the gas is high, temperature is high. It's a warm neutral medium. The temperature is about 7,000 or 8,000 Kelvin. The densities are low. The carbon emission rate now is much less than the total heating rate. Carbon emission now is a tiny fraction. Most of the cooling here is due to Lyman alpha. And in fact, it goes asymptotically to a constant here because you have to include CMB radiative excitations at high redshift. This guy has a redshift of 3.9, it turns out. I increase the density, everything stays the same until I hit some critical density, and you get a phase transition. And you go from a warm neutral medium where the gas is thermally stable to an unstable zone between these two points to a cold neutral medium. Now, in the cold neutral medium, where the temperature is like 100 Kelvin, the density is more like 10 or 20 particles per cubic centimeter. Here, the carbon cooling rate equals the heating rate, and this just reflects the grain photoelectric heating rate. The grains are becoming more neutral. The quantum efficiency is the same. Remember, along this curve, we have the same mean intensity of radiation. So can this background heating explain the cooling rates that we see in DLAs? So let me just start out in the case of the objects where we actually get positive detections. So these curves are just what I showed just now, but these are for three different models of dust. We wanted to make sure we covered most of our bases here. The horizontal line is the data with the one sigma error bars. But you can see in most cases that the observations are significantly above, okay, the cooling rates predicted by background heating, okay? That's not always true. In some cases, if the density is high enough, like here or here, background heating can do it. However, if background heating alone is what's doing it, the densities can't be that high. And the reason is that we don't see carbon-1 in most damp Lyman alpha systems. The carbon-2 to carbon-1 ratio is enormous. It's at least 1,000. In some cases, the lower limit is 10,000. And that ratio for photoionization equilibrium is proportional to the mean intensity of far UV radiation over the electron density. Since that mean intensity is so low for background radiation, that means the density really has to be low. And that's what these arrows here are. So in most cases, okay, we cannot explain the cooling rates we see in DLAs as due to heating and thermal equilibrium by the background radiation. That's not true in exactly every case, but it's true in certainly the vast majority of the cases. So for that reason, we need some star formation. We need some extra source of intensity, and that's what this figure is supposed to be. So that's that same DLA that I showed before. Here's this carbon heating cooling rate versus density. But now, these blue curves, I'm adding on increasing amount of mean intensity, increasing amount of star formation rate, okay? So you see all these curves eventually go through the data point. Which ones should we use? So for that, we appeal to analogy with the interstellar medium. We appeal to the pressure curves, okay? And you can see the pressure curves have this characteristic maximum and minimum. And in the ISM, it turns out, there's a very nice paper by McKee and colleagues again on this, who show that the pressure is not arbitrary. The pressure in the interstellar medium always seems to lie between this Pmax and this Pmin. And this gives rise to the idea of a two-phase medium. We have this isobar over here, which intersects these curves in two thermally stable states, a thermally stable cold neutral medium state and a thermally stable warm neutral medium state. So for each mean intensity, there are two unique states that I'm going to assume that this DLA can be. And the locus of these states, okay, is given over here. So for each mean intensity, okay, we have two unique densities, two curves, and the intersection of these solutions with the data gives us the star formation rate. So you can see for the cold neutral medium curve, we get a rather low star formation rate. For the warm neutral medium curve, we get a much higher star formation rate. So that's basically, so we construct diagrams like this for all our objects. So let me just step back and just sort of give you a picture of what I'm assuming here. I'm assuming, at least for this cold neutral medium, warm neutral medium model, that the line of sight goes through both warm gas and cold gas. I'm assuming the cold gas has a fairly high area covering factor, okay, and that all the C2 absorption arises in this cold medium. And in this case, what we expect is that the mean intensity won't be that much higher than that of the galaxy. For the warm neutral medium model, okay. For the warm neutral medium model, it doesn't go, the C2 star rises in the warm neutral medium model, and we need a much higher mean intensity. Okay, so this is what the star formation rates look like. Okay, as I said, for the cold neutral medium model, the star formation rates being an area are not much higher than that in the galaxy. For the warm neutral medium model, they're much, much higher. Okay. What about the upper limits? In the case of the upper limits, it really depends on, again, I did the same type of calculation. It really depends where the actual carbon II emission rates are. But in most cases, okay, again, these are the background heating cases, the upper limits probably do intersect the background. So I'm going to assume, and there are other arguments which I don't have time to describe right now, which demonstrate that in this case, in cases where we don't detect carbon II emission, that the gas is in fact heated by the background radiation, and it turns out it has to be warm neutral medium gas in this case, so it's very different. All right, so to make further progress, we then went into made some cosmological considerations. We then, yes, it's one of the few cases where cosmology solves some problems rather than creates it. We were able to calculate the star formation rate per co-moving volume, okay, make a Madow diagram for DLAs. So the co-moving star formation rate is equal to co-moving density times the star formation rate. We don't know either of those, but we do know what the incidence of dent, Lyman, alpha systems along the line of sight is. And we just combine these two equations, and we get that the star formation rate per co-moving volume equals the star formation rate per unit H1 area times the incidence of DLAs, which we know very well. So what we did is we calculated the average star formation rates per unit area. As I said, in the case of the upper limits, the star formation rates are much lower than the background, so we can ignore them in the average. And we calculated it. It turns out that in the case of the warm neutral medium model, the star formation rate is a volume emissivity. That's a source function for background radiation. We generate way too much background radiation, way above the 95% confidence upper limit for the bolometric background. So the bottom line is that the only model that really survives is this cold plus warm model. And these are our data points over here, these large green points over here. The error bars are large because we have large systematic errors. They dominate any random errors because we don't know the grain composition. It could be silicates or carbonaceous. We're not sure about the pressure. We think we've been pretty liberal about this. But nonetheless, what I've also shown here are the Chuck's stuff on Lyman break galaxies, okay? Of course, there should be more data here now, but they all agree with these points. I've just left it out, and these are some lower redshift stuff. But the interesting point is that from completely different physics, we get a star formation rate per co-moving volume, which is very similar to the Lyman break galaxies, which suggests that maybe they are overlapping populations. Okay, so there are a number of implications of this, and I don't have time to go through it. The most important one is that we produce too many metals. This was mentioned yesterday. We compared our, well, we didn't do it, actually. Nagamini Spring on Hernquist did it. They, in their hierarchical simulations, Lambda CDM universe, they calculated the metallicities of dent Lyman alpha systems. And they found that there were about a factor of 10 more metals than are observed. And we did the same thing, and other people have found that. I'm sorry? Observed and absorption, like I was just saying. The DLA metallicities are lower than what they calculate. And they get the same star formation rates than we do. There are a number of ways out of that. Actually, I'm not that worried about it. One way, just since this winds have been emphasized in this meeting, we know that starburst galaxies eject metal-loaded winds. Perhaps the metal enrichment does not mean, metal production does not necessarily mean metal enrichment. Another possibility is that star formation is occurring not uniformly throughout the DLA, but maybe in a bulge or some area displaced from the line of sight. And so you metal enrich this system very rapidly. We know that bulges are an old but metal-rich population, and UV light leaks out and heats the gas further out. And when you work it out, the luminosity requirement is no different. So let me finish by saying that we have several tests of this hypothesis. We think the best case is this DLA, 2206 minus 19A, it turns out, because this is the one dent Lyman alpha system that's really been detected recently in emission by Polly Muller. And we can compare the mean intensities that we get from our technique with the ones that he measures from photometry. So here is the carbon 2 fine structure, the C2 star line in this object. Okay, it occurs in the Lyman alpha forest. It's blended with the Lyman alpha forest line, but its structure, velocity structure, probably looks more like that of the resonance line, so we corrected for that. But what's most exciting to me is that this is the galaxy that Muller and his colleagues saw with the VLT. I think this is a STIS image. When I say they saw with the VLT, they got a spectrum of it with the VLT. From here to here is about 1 arc second, about 8.5 kiloparsecs at a redshift of 1.9. Lyman alpha emission has been detected from this knot. O3 emission has been detected from that knot, and they both agree with the redshift of the DLA. But the neat thing is that we can measure the luminosity in each pixel and then compute what the mean intensity at the line of sight should be. And the agreement is pretty good. Okay, I mean, it's not a fabulous agreement, but it's certainly consistent agreement. This is the what they get from photometry. It's only an upper limit because we don't know the physical distance between the source and the line of sight. All we have is a lower limit from the projected distance. And this is what we get for our CNM model, which is certainly consistent with the photometry. The warm neutral medium model, despite the error bars, these are 95% confidence errors, and we're pretty confident that we can rule it out. And in fact, in some ways, it's not surprising that this is the object that we found, because we predicted it to be the highest star formation rate per unit area of any object in our sample. This is a distribution of the mean intensities, okay, that we predict. And 2206 minus 19A is this guy right over here. More recently, another object was found by Muller and his colleagues, and this was our second brightest object. So we think we're onto something. Remember, for years, people have been looking to see emission from Dent Lyman alpha systems and been shooting blindly. Now we think we have a criteria to go to. In fact, we've got space telescope time to take ACS images of objects that lie along this bright. It's mean intensity in some dimensionless units. This is some obscure interstellar thing in Hobbing units, it's called. Don't ask me. All right. So to end up, I think there are two classes of Dent Lyman alpha systems. That's the message I want to put forward. When the carbon 2 cooling rate is higher than what we predict for the background, I think there we're looking at moderate density gas that's heated locally by starlight in the DLA. And in that case, the C2 star absorption arises in the CNM. We don't know yet what the spatial distribution is. Are the stars, the sources of the light, distributed uniformly through the stars, or are they centrally located? In this last thing we looked at, the DLA, that the line of sight, this model would be more appropriate. Why is that? I think in this case, what you have to have, to get a two-phase medium, the hydrostatic pressure of the gas has to be greater than this piece of min, than this minimum pressure. And if you look at all the models for galaxy formation, that would suggest that this is a fairly massive galaxy, maybe a few times 10 to 10, 10 to 11th or more solar masses of dark matter, at least in the models of Nagamini and Sprindlin Hernquist. For the cases where the cooling rate is low, I think what's going on there, you have a single phase medium because there the pressure is below this piece of min, so you can't get a two-phase medium. And in that case, the gas is heated by external background radiation. And in that case, you have a warm neutral medium. And I think, you know, we haven't done this in any precise manner yet, but this is sort of consistent with their probability distributions that they get. These are the differential probability distributions that they got from their simulations. And for us, the best one would be this simulation where they had winds, because in that case, the median dark matter mass was certainly higher than in the other case where they went all the way down to 10 to the 8 solar masses and without any strong winds, without any feedback. So for us, feedback is good because the median mass will be higher. We'll get a higher percentage of more massive galaxies where we think the pressure is high and we can get a two-phase medium. Okay, and here's my summary view graph. Okay, that I think the interesting thing about DLAs is that they're neutral gas reservoirs for star formation at high redshifts. The metallicity is about minus 1.3 dec. At least in the cases where you have positive detections, I just want to emphasize the point that the optical depth of C2 star does not directly depend on abundance or anything else like that. is just determined by the heating rate alone, okay? And that heating rate is proportional to the star formation rate peak in an H1 area. And in the cases where we get positive detections, the star formation rate per unit area is not that much different than it is in the Milky Way. There's uncertainty in this number, but at least it's a few times. We find that the co-moving star formation rate is similar to that of Lyman Break galaxies. I think there's a good chance that there's a lot of overlap between those populations. We're probably going further down the luminosity function than 27th magnitude. And as I said, there are two types of DLAs for the reasons that I said. And which I don't have time to talk about, is one way to really ultimately find out a lot of the properties of these is to detect this 158 micron emission with ALMA, and see the 158 micron line in emission. And the only way I think we can do that is with the ALMA telescope. Okay, thanks.
Art, I'm trying to combine your description, or reconcile, I should say, with a picture of the interstellar medium of our own galaxy, in which the energetics of the interstellar medium are dominated by the supernova explosions of stars, and where the other energetically important contribution of stars is the ionizing starlight that is absorbed in the H2 regions. And those are both ignored in your picture of the interstellar medium,
well,
and I don't understand why they don't dominate.
Let me explain why we ignored it.
Okay.
First of all, there's really no evidence for a WIM in these objects. Okay, this ionized gas has a different velocity structure than the neutral gas. In our own galaxy, the warm ionized medium has the same velocity structure as the WIM. The other very important evidence in our own galaxy that for ionized gas being important for the C2 star is when you plot this emission rate versus condensity, it goes up as the condensity goes down. And the reason is that the neutral fraction is going down. We don't see any evidence for that. We looked at that very carefully. So yes, there is ionized gas in the damp Lyman. There's presumably a hot ionized medium. We don't know about it yet. But at least within the context of this cooling and heating, it does not seem to be a warm ionized medium like in our own galaxy. It's not intermixed with the neutral gas. We think it's physically disjoint. And as I said, the carbon-4, silicon-4 lines, which are photoionized, have a very different velocity structure than all the low ions.
I can see how you would make them to be physically distinct regions.
However, if most of the energy going into the galaxy's interstellar medium is explosion energy and H2 region ionizing radiation, I don't see how the energy can stay distinct. I mean, there will be parts of your neutral medium which are shock heated by those explosions. They'll be converting from one component to
the
other.
The two-phase medium still works extremely well for the ISM of our galaxy. Wolf-Fired L just showed that. Okay, there's no difference. I don't understand your point.
Okay. I think I can ask a question that might illuminate Paul's point. I mean, which is, I think the place where you probably do run into problems is you've tried to detach the star formation region from the remainder of the material, right? Because in fact, the thing that keeps clouds, the cold clouds moving around in our own interstellar medium
is
the energy input from supernova
remnants. One possibility is that the star formation is occurring in molecular clouds that we don't see, and our shocks propagate out from that and energize the gas that we do detect.
I think the real point is that you need to co-distribute the star formation with the material. You can't do what you wanted to do in separating it out and then propagating
radiation. But I don't think it's going to change these numbers, Len.
That's the important point. I think the one place where it causes you trouble, right, is when you were trying to get out of the metal generation problem by detaching the star formation from the gas.
That's right.
And I don't think you're really permitted to do that. Right, so that I think is the point that Paul's really trying to get at. And I think another point that comes in here as well, this actually wasn't my question, this is prompted by Paul, right, is that in fact, I mean, you also need to worry about non-static pressures. I mean, I don't think our interstellar medium has a single pressure in it, right? You actually have dynamic pressure.
You're absolutely right. And this is, prime. But it would be nuts for us to start at a very complicated model at a high redshift. We want to start out with the simplest model, push it as far as we can. Then we'll worry about non-equilibrium things. And things like
absolutely,
that.
And fully understood. let me ask.
He agrees.
Of course, I agree with you. I always agree with you. Let me ask my actual question, which is: some of the systems that you're looking at actually do have carbon one, like 1331,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Those presumably are cases where the density really is high.
No, I worked that out, Lynn. That's in here. Thank you for asking that. Let's see. I hope I can find it. Yeah, that's one of the systems we did do. It's high, but it's not that high. It's still consistent. We can still rule out background heating for that object. Okay, here it is. Yeah, so here's, as you said, 1331 plus 170. That's no longer an upper limit. That's a detection. Okay, but still background heating is not going to work. We do, especially for that object, we need a fair amount of star formation.
But I think the actual question is, do you see any systematic differences between your system and the other one, right? Because if you know in those cases, you have to be in the high density.
I understand that the only thing I know about this one, I should have said this before, that I think this has a fairly high molecular content. That's the rumor from Jill Beckpohl. That's about the only difference that I can tell. And I should have said before, I'm sorry I left out, Andrea Ferrara has done some very nice work looking at, there's a small subset of these systems that we see H2 molecules. And you can work out the radiation field by, you know, comparing photodissociation with molecule formation on grain surfaces, and they get a radiation field very similar to what we get. I don't know what the agreement is, but factor of two or something.
Yeah.
It's similar, yeah. So that also gives me confidence in the results.
When you showed the Mueller picture of the damp galaxy nearby, and presumably where the flux is where most of the star formation is, it made me realize I didn't understand something that you're doing, and I apologize for that. It seems to me that in order to get a star formation rate, you have to decide how far are the stars from the place where you're measuring the effect. So if they're very near to the gas where you're seeing the T2 star, you might have a low star formation rate. So if I moved the Mueller galaxy further away, wouldn't you deduce a higher star formation for it?
No, remember, we deduce it from the absorption lines alone. This is just a test. Okay. We did this before we even knew about this. So we got a JNU. And then later on I found out about this, and it could have been wrong. I mean, if this galaxy were over here somewhere, then we would not have agreement with the data.
That's right. So how did you manage to predict where the galaxy was? That's the bit I don't understand.
I didn't predict where
how far it was from
the
site line.
Remember, our technique from this two-phase model, we predict what the mean intensity is. It doesn't have anything to do with where the galaxy is.
But you're giving a star formation rate, not intensity.
No. I'm sorry. Let me backtrack. I didn't talk about star formation rate here. I just talked about mean intensity.
I thought you showed a hot medallion.
Later on, I did. Yeah, but at this point over here, okay, for this particular case, we just stuck with mean intensity. The mean intensities agree. The hot medallion thing, yes, we assume the model. It turns out it doesn't matter. Even if you have a point source, okay, and the line of sight going over here, or sources distributed, you roughly get the same luminosity per galaxy. The luminosity goes like R squared times J nu. The J nu is measured. And what R squared is something like the impact parameter squared. So it turns out when you average over all impact parameters, independent of how you distribute the stars, you get the same luminosity.
So you need a galaxy model. So you're putting
the
distance
in
there.
That's right. So one model was a point source. The other model was a uniform gas. And we felt that covers most of the bases.